Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
All right, from the BBC. Online photos and videos can alter the way you think.
You don't say.
So with the average user spending about 6 hours and 40 minutes a day on the internet, obviously some of that is going to be work for some.
Some of that is Internet George, who spends 23 and a half hours a day, should not have been counted.
Yeah, some of that is a 10-hour loop of Star Trek bridge sounds just so that you can get a good night's sleep, whatever the case is. But
right, right.
6 hours and 40 minutes. You can imagine how billions of images are going to make up a significant portion of your everyday visual input. And one study published earlier this year looked at what genders predominated when they searched for different occupations. Farmer, CEO, TV reporter. Any guesses? Yeah, you already know what I'm going to say. The findings were stark. The author found that photographs of male doctors outstripped female doctors by 3-1. Even though in the US, for example, physicians under 44 at the time were more likely to be female than male in actuality. There were twice as many options for photos of women with babies, or for that matter, of women with salads. So the latest study, however, takes this even further. So rather than just showing the extent of gender bias in online imagery, the researchers tested whether exposure to these images had any impact on people's own biases. In the experiment, 423 participants used Google to search for different occupations. Two groups searched by text using either Google or Google News. Another group used Google Images. And a control group also used Google, but it was to search for categories unrelated to occupations like Apple or guitar. Then all participants were given an implicit association test. The participants who used Google Images showed much higher rates of implicit gender bias both immediately after and even 3 days later. Researchers of the study wrote, "Our findings are especially alarming given that image-based social media platforms such as Instagram are surging in popularity, accelerating the mass production and circulation of images. In parallel, popular search engines like Google are increasingly incorporating images into their core functionality by including images as a default part of text-based searches." And there's another growing problem, too. The images already circulating online, well, we already know they're informing and shaping AI models, right? Now, earlier this year, the author experimented on this by asking ChatGPT to create images of dozens of professionals, and it delivered again and again, not just a man, but a slim white man around his 30s with a crop of flowing brown hair. So in a later attempt, trying to get away from career bias, the author asked ChatGPT to come up with different sorts of people. Someone smart, someone successful, someone watching an opera, someone who quit their job. Once again, the author got the white guy with the lustrous hair. What a busy dude. So what can be done? Well, a good deal of responsibility lies with the tech and AI companies.
Oh, no.
I know.
But even when their intentions are good, there doesn't seem to be an easy fix. In its attempt to correct for racial, gender, and other biases, for example, Google's AI tool Gemini can sometimes overcorrect, right? One image it generated of the U.S. founding fathers included a black man, which, you know, give me that time.
Right.
For another example, they had an image of German soldiers from World War II featuring a black and an Asian woman, which, I don't know, maybe is a preview for three. But in the meantime, we need to take control of shaping our digital world ourselves. Seeking out accounts and influencers who are of a different ethnic or racial background, or making a point to view photographers from different parts of the world, that's one easy, actionable tip to introduce diversity within your personalized algo ecosystem.
Well, here's the thing. I'll tell you what doesn't have images, and that's podcasts. So we're doing fine. Like, possibly our listeners are imagining us all as white men with brown hair, but I assure you we're not. And well, okay. 25% of us.
Statistical averages are going to show up. They're just gonna, right?
That's right. That's
okay, right. I'm done. Next link?
Next link.
This article comes to us from Ars Technica. It's titled Airborne Microplastics Aid in Cloud Formation.
I mean, I guess that's nice. I like clouds.
Yeah, that's useful, right? How very helpful. At least it's in the air and not in the water. No, sorry. It's everywhere. So clouds form when water vapor sticks to tiny floating particles such as dust and turns into liquid water droplets or ice crystals. This process, which occurs constantly in the atmosphere, is called nucleation. And this matters because most precipitation typically starts as ice particles. If ice doesn't develop, clouds tend to evaporate rather than causing rain or snowfall. While children learn in grade school that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees Celsius, that's not always true. Without something to nucleate onto, such as dust particles, water can be supercooled to temperatures as low as minus 36 Fahrenheit or minus 38 degrees Celsius before it freezes. For freezing to occur at warmer temperatures, some kind of material that won't dissolve in water needs to be present in the droplet. Mm. This particle provides a surface where the first ice crystal can form. So, to see whether microplastic fragments could serve as nuclei for water droplets, the authors used four of the most prevalent types of plastics in the atmosphere. Low-density polyethylene, polypropylene, polyvinyl chloride, and polyethylene terephthalate.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. Tasty. Each was tested both in a pristine state and after exposure to ultraviolet light, ozone, and acids. They suspended those microplastics in small water droplets and slowly cooled the droplets to observe when they froze. They also analyzed the plastic fragment's surfaces to determine their molecular structure, since ice nucleation could depend on the microplastic's surface chemistry. For most of the plastics we studied, 50% of the droplets were frozen by the time they cooled to minus 8 Fahrenheit or minus 22 Celsius. These results parallel those from another recent study by Canadian scientists who also found that some types of microplastics nucleate ice at warmer temperatures than droplets without microplastics. Hmm. Exposure to ultraviolet radiation, ozone, and acids tended to decrease ice nucleation activity on the particles. However, these plastics still nucleated ice, so they could still affect the amount of ice in clouds. What isn't known is to understand how microplastics affect weather and climate, they need to know their concentrations at the altitudes where clouds form. We would also need to understand the concentration of microplastics compared with other particles that could nucleate ice, such as mineral dust and biological particles, to see whether microplastics are present at comparable levels. And plastic fragments come in many sizes and compositions, so in future research, the authors plan to work with plastics that contain additives such as plasticizers and colorants, as well as with smaller plastic particles.
I mean, I guess the result of that is just them saying, ooh, look, this one kind of plastic is not as bad, so let's start making all our plastic out of phthalates instead of whatever. But that doesn't solve the actual problem.
Yeah, it could be that, I mean, the most generous, optimistic interpretation I take here is maybe microplastics are actually kind of saving our ass in response to CO2 and oil and gas because they allow the temperature to cool because it reflects the sun. But again, that's a big, 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 very long-armed, closing my eyes and crossing my fingers reach.
Right. So, well, and then it just rains down upon us and now it's in our water supply and now it's bad for us again. So it's like,
yeah. It's like, do you want to die from very soon heat death or very slow microplastic poisoning?
Slow microplastic poisoning.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, if I have to choose, I guess I'm going with slow. So
why not a little bit of both?
Yeah. And again, the science on this is not settled. We don't know what the final conclusion of this could be, but it's super interesting that it's even affecting our climate in the air itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many knock-on effects that we're not even aware of that we've already instituted. Like, these are microplastics that are already in the air. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of like, oh, hey, now if we try to take them out, it might get even worse. Good job, guys.
Yeah, at least we're doing the due diligence to figure out what exactly it's doing.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This article is for those of us who are terrified of going into our attics. This comes from Vice. New homeowners find skeleton in attic 15 years after previous owner vanished.
Wow.
Whoa, they lived there for 15 years? Or no?
Well, they didn't. They just moved in. So the homeowners found the skeleton shortly after moving into a house in France. Mm. So in a scene that's played out countless times in horror movies, one of the owners navigating their way around the attic to try to figure out where a leak was coming from. They finessed their way into a cubbyhole and came face to face with a corpse. Again, why I'm not going to my attic.
Because you'd rather just stay up there.
Yeah, I don't want to know. If you were up there for a while, that's fine. Be up there. So they bought the house in 2023. So they were up there for a year. Officials believe it is the body of a previous owner who had vanished 15 years ago. The man in question went missing in 2009. His wife lived there by herself until 2020 died.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So many questions now.
I mean, I feel like I have answers. I don't know that there's that many questions. Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, officials believe that it was suicide, according to CBS News. At this point in time, it's so decomposed that it's going to be tough. All they have are skeletal remains, which are now being studied to determine the cause of death and see who the person actually is. But I think we know. As for the people living in the house, how do you sleep?
I mean, honestly, the house now is like certified skeleton free. What they should be afraid of is the next house, right? Like now they're going to be afraid of any new houses, but they know they got all the ones out of this one.
But did the ghosts leave? And apparently, you know, this isn't anything new. Earlier this year, construction workers came across some bones when excavating a pool in Florida. And a few years ago, there were skeletal remains discovered in a Texas barbecue pit. And in the article, too, this is from Vice, right? And they have a whole bunch of more like this. They also have French man finds skeleton in his basement. Then 37 more. So I guess France doesn't have any home inspectors.
Yeah. Or you just like, once you've stuffed the body up in the attic, you just know I got to live here till I die.
Right. But even the people moving in, like if the inspector didn't find a dead body in the attic, what else did they miss?
That's true.
Wait. Why are we so sure we know who it is? Maybe the inspector was looking at something and couldn't get out.
Yeah. He went like Ark of the Covenant style really fast.
Maybe there's just no home inspection before you buy a house in France because they know that there's probably skeletons in there.
They're like, listen, this is a hassle. We're not going to look at every skeleton in every attic. Come on.
This
guys.
Is Europe. We've been doing this for ages. Of course we're on top of skeletons. We're like four layers deep at this point, right?
Right.
So y'all never know what's in your house, especially when you're moving in. Make sure you find a good inspector.
I mean, now I got to go up in my attic. Like, I feel like it's overdue for a search.
Yeah, and I'm not worried about a skeleton up there. I'm just worried about like rat turds and going, oh no, now I got to do something about this.
Yeah, better not to know.
No, yeah, just let him be. Let him be. All right, next link.
Next link.
All right, this next one is from the BBC and it's called A Look Inside Michelangelo's Secret Room. Yeah, I'm going to be honest. It's a pretty lame title in my opinion because it leaves out all of the drama. Because it makes it sound like, you know, this is just some room in Michelangelo's house where he'd go to be alone or whatever. But in fact, this was a tiny, mostly underground chamber where Michelangelo was forced to go into hiding for quite some time in order to avoid being murdered. Exactly. So now that I've got you hooked in a way that the BBC definitely did not, here's what happened. In 1527, Michelangelo was well established as an artist, and he was working under the patronage of the Medici family, who ruled the city of Florence at that time. They had established the Medici Chapel in the middle of the city, and one of the recurring sort of standard projects that he would do for them was to design and create sculptures of various family members that would eventually go on top of their tombs inside the chapel. Obviously, this family was very powerful. We still talk about them today. And a big part of the reason they held on to as much control as they did for as long as they did was they were generally supported by both the secular and religious powers in Rome. But as you may know from history, the secular and religious powers in Rome didn't always agree with each other. And in 1527, Holy Roman Emperor Charles V was having a little spat with Pope Clement VII, who was himself a member of the Medici family, by the way. And he threatened to invade Rome with his troops if the Pope didn't cave to his demands. Now, Charles V didn't actually intend to take the city. He was just trying to use it as a bargaining chip. but his soldiers were unpaid, hungry, and largely Protestant. So when Charles told them, hey guys, it's cool now, we're not really going to do that to the Pope, his soldiers were like, oh yes, we are, and they mutinied and stormed the city, looting and pillaging in what ultimately became known as the Sack of Rome. And when the common people in Florence got wind of this, they were like, hey, why not us, right? So the rebellious factions in the city, of what were called Republicans at the time, had a big riot and managed to expel the Medicis from the city. And from what we understand of Michelangelo's politics, he usually tended to stay pretty neutral. You know, he just wanted to make art and find people who were willing to pay him to do that. But this time, Michelangelo went all in with the Republicans. He was like, guys, I swear, I never liked my bosses to begin with. And he participated pretty significantly in the years that followed, including using his architecture skills to help build fortifications around the city. Unfortunately, the fortifications weren't enough, and 3 years later, the Medicis were back. And they weren't super thrilled with the fact that this artist, who they'd fully supported since he was a teenager, had turned on them in their absence. So he had to hide. And the prior of the Medici Chapel apparently convinced Michelangelo that the best place to hide would be right under their noses in a secret room beneath a trapdoor inside the Medici Chapel itself.
That's straight out of Arrested Development.
Yeah, it's bold. That's what it is.
He's in the attic the whole time.
Exactly. So the room was about 9 feet wide and just 7.5 feet tall at the peak of its arched ceiling. So the sides were considerably shorter. It was, however, 30 feet long, with a tiny little opening at the end that gave Michelangelo access to the street above in case he needed to make a quick getaway. And he stayed down there for 2 months, with food being brought in by the prior and his chamber pots taken away, until through some back-channel negotiations and just sort of general forgetfulness on their part, Michelangelo finally managed to secure the forgiveness of the Medici family and then went right back to work for them.
Yay!
So here's where it gets really cool. After those 2 months, the room went back to what it was before, which was storage. And over the centuries, the furniture got rearranged, things got moved on top of the trapdoor, and the room's entire existence was forgotten about. Fast forward to 1975. The Medici Chapel is now a museum, which has to deal with huge amounts of tourists coming through every day, and the director of the museum is re-examining the building's layout, looking for a way to add more exits, basically crowd control. He finds this trapdoor and a really filthy room underneath that had apparently been used for storing coal, and he tells one of his workers, hey, see if you can clean those walls off a little bit, and maybe we can use this weird long room as another passage out of the building. But then the wall guy comes back and is like, did you know there are drawings down there? Yeah, because it turns out if you lock an artist in a room for 2 months with nothing to do, he's going to draw on the walls.
True facts.
Now, there are still some scholars who say we can't be absolutely certain that this is really the room where Michelangelo hid or whether the sketches on the wall are really his. But aside from matching his style, several of the sketches are pretty clearly rough drafts of work he did later in the Sistine Chapel and elsewhere.
Oh.
So if it's a hoax, it's a pretty elaborate one and an old one, not a new one. And the museum, at least, has been proceeding under the assumption that they are genuine. They spent nearly 50 years painstakingly removing the outer layers of plaster to reveal the marks underneath until finally, in 2023, the room was opened to the public on a limited basis. How limited, you ask? Well, they only make appointments for 100 people a week for a maximum of 15 minutes, and you may rest assured they are booked solid for the foreseeable future.
Wow.
But there is a video at the link that gets close-ups on all the drawings. It's really pretty. So you can see what it looks like from that perspective.
It's almost like it wasn't just a panic room or a safe room. It was also like his little spiritual hut where he could just face the abyss.
Well, and none of the drawings are small, I should point out. It's these big sweeping figures that cover the entire length of the 30-foot passageway. So it's a lot of artwork. And they made a note of, like, it was mostly drawn in charcoal, which he probably would have done by, like, burning the end of a stick to get the charcoal. Like, he didn't have any art supplies down there. So it's all very cool. And it's amazing to me that at some point somebody plastered over all that, and then they went and were able to remove it and still leave the charcoal underneath. Like, how do you strip plaster and leave charcoal lines?
With a lot of money.
Yeah. Medici money is what that is, baby. Next link?
Next link.
Ah, good news, everyone. Stanford is reporting that scientists have glued two proteins together, which is causing cancer cells to self-destruct.
Oh, that sounds promising.
Yeah, this is a new technique they're hoping will flip lymphoma in particular from preventing cell death to triggering it. So our bodies normally divest themselves of about 60 billion cells every day through a natural process of cell culling and turnover called apoptosis. So they want to use this natural method of cell death to trick cancer cells into effectively disposing of themselves. The method accomplishes this by artificially bringing together two proteins in such a way that the new compound switches on a set of cell death genes. The idea came to Gerald Crabtree, MD, a professor of developmental biology, during a pandemic stroll through the forests west of Palo Alto, California. Crabtree, who is a longtime cancer biologist, he was thinking about major milestones in biology. And one of the milestones, he pondered, was the 1970s era discovery that cells trigger their own death for the greater good of the organism. Now, apoptosis turns out to be critical for many biological processes, like proper development of all organs, the fine-tuning of our immune systems. That system retains pathogen-recognizing cells, but kills off self-recognizing ones, thus preventing autoimmune disease if you are without an autoimmune condition, right?
Not doing that so well these days, I think, but you know, we're working on it.
But it occurred to Crabtree, well, gee, this is the way we want to treat cancer. We essentially want to have the same kind of specificity that can eliminate 60 billion cells with no bystanders, so no cell is killed that is not the proper object of the killing mechanism. So they developed a kind of molecule with a molecular glue that sticks together two proteins that normally would have nothing to do with each other. So one of the proteins is BCL6, and when it mutates, it drives the blood cancer known as diffuse large cell B-cell lymphoma. So yeah, reality check, we're talking about lymphoma and a very specific kind of lymphoma. Now, this kind of cancer-driving protein is also referred to as an oncogene. In lymphoma, the mutated BCL6 sits on DNA near apoptosis-promoting genes and keeps them switched off. And what that does is help the cancer cell retain that immortality we hate so much, right? That's how it can keep on living. So what they did is they developed a molecule that tethers this BCL6 to a protein known as CDK9. That acts as an enzyme that catalyzes gene activation. So in this case, switching on that set of apoptosis genes that BCL6 normally keeps off. So the idea is you take something that the cancer is addicted to for its survival, you flip the script and make that be the very thing that kills it. So it seems to be, I mean, this is obviously a very specific process for a specific kind of cell, namely lymphoma. And because BCL6 normally acts on 13 different apoptosis-promoting genes, they're hoping this strategy can avoid the treatment resistance that seems really common in cancer. Because cancer is often able to rapidly adapt to therapies that target only one of the disease weak spots, and some of the therapies may stop cancer from growing without killing the cells entirely. So they're hoping that by blasting the cells with multiple different cell death signals at once, the cancer won't even survive long enough to evolve resistance. But, you know, that's the brass ring there.
I mean, I hope so. I like the idea of tricking the cells with processes they're already doing. That seems way more effective in the long run, though it does seem more complicated than just throwing a bunch of poison at it.
Right. Strategic, but potentially really efficient and potent. Next link?
Next link.
This is a short one that comes to us from phys.org. It's titled, Chimpanzees Perform Better on Challenging Computer Tasks When They Have an Audience.
Oh, honestly, same. Like,
me too, yeah.
Well, this explains streamers.
Yeah. So when people have an audience watching them, it can change their performance for better or worse. Now, researchers reporting in iScience on November 8th have found that chimpanzees' performance on computer tasks is influenced by the number of people watching them. Kristen Lin of Kyoto University in Japan says it was very surprising to find that chimpanzees are affected in their task performance by audience members and by human audience members nonetheless. Now, I'll just tell you, if you've ever seen a cat just totally bomb a landing, they get embarrassed. They know you saw
it. Yeah, they know that you got watched. Yeah.
So this does not just apply to chimpanzees, in my unprofessional opinion.
Yeah, it's also a little silly to be like, they even care when humans watch. Humans are the ones who feed them. Humans are the ones who are deeply enmeshed in them, even more than chimpanzees in the wild are.
Not just enmeshed, but hold dominant power over. So if they're asking you to do something, you're going to give it your all, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you just can't get away from the observer effect, even with chimpanzees.
No. These are quantum chimps is what they are.
So the researchers, including Shinya Yamamoto and Akio Muramatsu, wanted to find out if the audience effect often attributed in humans to that reputation management might also exist in a non-human primate. People, they knew, pay attention to who's watching them, sometimes even subconsciously, in ways that affect their performance. And while chimps live in hierarchical societies, it wasn't clear to what extent they too might be influenced by those watching them. Muramatsu says, "Our study site is special in that chimpanzees frequently interact with and even enjoy the company of humans here, participating almost daily in various touchscreen experiments for food rewards." The researchers made the discovery after analyzing thousands of sessions in which chimpanzees completed a touchscreen task over 6 years. They found in 3 different number-based tasks that chimpanzees performed better on the most difficult task as the number of experimenters watching them increased. In contrast, they also found that for the easiest task, chimpanzees performed worse when being watched by more experimenters or other familiar people.
That's like when something goes horribly wrong and you look like an idiot because you were being watched.
Every time someone watches me type, all the typos, I forget how to type. Oh, am I driving? Am I driving you somewhere? I don't know how to drive anymore.
Yeah
and exactly.
It's interesting that if something is really difficult, the pressure helps in some way, but if it's just like a normal thing you're used to doing and you have more and more people watching, you're just like, oh, I don't know how to speak or like write or use the keyboard. Like what, what's going on here?
Especially if that person is an authority.
Yes.
So I watch students all the time and I'll just, all right, share your screen with me. And they all of a sudden don't know how to navigate their computer.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know how to do this. It's up there in the top left corner. Just press the thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Like, performance anxiety, huh?
Yeah.
It feels like an extension of the whole theory of like all the eyes in the dark watching you kind of thing, but also encompasses, you know, your social group. And it's especially awkward if, you know, there's like a cat randomly watching you and judging you. And you're like, why do you care, cat? This has nothing to do with you. But you can't help but feel judged because cats are experts at that.
Right. Stop looking at me, poop dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Here's a fun fact. This podcast drops on Friday, November 15th, which just so happens to be our 5-year anniversary of doing this podcast, which is kind of insane.
Oh my gosh.
I feel old, but but we're very glad that we get to keep doing it and that you all keep listening and supporting us. We appreciate that. We're going to keep going as long as we possibly can until we get an audience that's watching us, and then we're done. We'll forget how to do it.
Oh, what is talking even?
Exactly. That being said, there are many more articles on DamnInteresting.com that we did not have time to get to. Some of those articles include The Shipwreck Detective, Chimney Sweeps and the Turn Against Child Labor, and The Periodic Table in a 2D World. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today and everything we've talked about for the past 5 years, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast, you are more than welcome to support us at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.